This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by Tridel to Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with Tridel to Private Wealth. I am joined by Paul Simon, Head of Fixed Income with Tridel to Private Wealth. Paul has spent the past 6 years with Tridelta and previously worked with CI Investments in a career that spans 25 years. Paul also obtained his CFA designation in 2004. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Kyle. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you. Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the Tridelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series is to discuss recent market developments, what we are watching, and ultimately what action Tridelta is taking within our own client portfolios. Paul, before we go any further, maybe you can take us through what your role is with Tridelta and the strategies that you manage.
Sure. My role at Tridelta is to oversee the publicly available fixed income opportunities that are out in the marketplace, working with financial advisors to develop strategies and investment opportunities on behalf of clients. This includes fixed income, both in high quality investment grade and speculative grade bonds, as well as preferred shares that are available here in Canada. I do also work as part of the investment committee on the alternative investment side of things. And in partnership with the advisors, we discuss what opportunities are most suitable for clients. And I develop fixed income models that are selected by the advisors for implementation in the asset mix for clients. We specialize these models for clients depending on their personal investment needs.
And how have your strategies leaned in the the last several years? So you mentioned kind of looking to fit what the client needs are and what the market opportunities are. I know we'll get more into that in a little bit, but at a high level, what are those opportunities that you're currently managing towards?
Well, Tridelta is always working dynamically with the wealth advisors and clients to develop models that would be most suitable for their needs. And therefore, we have to be responsive both to what clients are seeking and to what opportunities are publicly available. So in the recent past, clients have been a little less attuned to fixed income markets because yields were low and credit spread opportunities, that is the amount that we're being compensated for involving ourselves with riskier credit, we provided meager compensation to clients, and clients had to look to other investment opportunities to achieve their target returns with a modicum of risk or the suitable risk profile for their particular needs. In recent months, in recent years, with the change in the interest rate outlook, we've actually reoriented ourselves towards a more traditional mix of fixed income opportunities. So this includes government bonds, investment grade bonds, and high yield bonds. As of now, the strategies that our clients are most heavily utilizing would be a Canadian-based investment grade investment model that includes both government and corporate bonds. We have one other Canadian-based investment-grade model that is exclusively for corporate bonds, because Tridelta has some clients who would rather issue government risk and government debt at this time for their own reasons and very good reasons. And finally, we have a shorter-term duration model that is targeted towards clients who don't really want to take on interest rate risk at this time, but do want to have access to high-quality bonds with reasonable yields to sort of countervail some of the other asset mix orientations within their asset mix.
So going a little deeper, we certainly always emphasize the need for active management in your in portfolios for clients. How have your mandates performed relative to their benchmarks, and what decisions do you attribute to your success?
Well, I would always advocate for active management over passive management. And I think it's never been more important to do so. Because of some of the sort of secular evolutions taking place in the investable marketplace at the current point in time, the types of things that investors can find in the fixed income space are changing as a result of changes in the way that finance is intermediated and changes in the way the economy operates. So this means that you have to be more finely attuned to the types of risks that you're taking on when investing in the fixed income space. And you have to be able to gauge how the evolving landscape will have impacts on the types of things you own in order to make changes to meet the new investment paradigm in which we're operating. Beyond that, I think it's always accretive to an investor to be able to make shifts between sectors and in also between different exposures to interest rates all along the interest rate curve as we look at the marketplace. And that simply doesn't happen in a passive mandate. Also, one thing to be mindful of that might be of interest to our investor or our client base is that as we've moved along here, the investment grade, actually the entire bond universe, the interest rate risk that's embedded in that universe has increased over time as people who issue bonds have lengthened out the maturity of those bonds. And if you're a passive investor, whether you know it or not, you're increasingly being exposed to longer and more interest rate risk, which might not be something you can monitor in real time, and only an active manager will be able to make the relative value assessments about whether or not you're being properly compensated for that risk.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point too, because I think there's a lot of people who sort of are the DIY or just working with a bank advisor who, you know, maybe they just buy on the equity side an S&P 500 passive ETF, and they're completely right that when these really successful companies are doing really well, those are becoming more and more of the index, which can lead to its own troubles. But for bonds, the more indebted companies are often taking up more of that passive ETF, which might be an underlying risk that people aren't always aware of, right?
That's correct. And those companies may have a lot of cachet with investors. They tend to be companies who are very well heeled anyway, mm-hmm. would be issuing debt opportunistically. And so when you're buying the bond that is coming to market, you're probably not getting at the most attractive yield at that point in time. And particularly as we move into a different era when money is a little less commonly available to any and all borrowers, you might want to be a little bit more discriminating about what you're being paid and by whom in order to mitigate some of those risks and make sure that you're being properly properly compensated for those risks. And beyond that, the largest issuers, governments out there, are increasingly terming out their debt as well. So if you're involved in a general bond ETF, you're getting more and more government exposure at longer and longer terms to maturity, generally with lower and lower yields in terms of compensation.
Yeah, and we saw how disastrous that was in the year like 2022 when bond indices in Canada and the US were both down double digits. And, you know, I think people may have before that anticipated as more of a defensive area of their portfolio. And as we'll speak about in a few minutes around rising correlation, it certainly was not.
And again, that's one of those situations where an active manager can be mindful of a paradigm shift into a more normalizing interest rate environment, something we hadn't seen in a number of years, mm-hmm. whereas a passive product won't allow you to dodge those effects.
And if memory serves me right, you did make that decision, I think in 2020 or 2021, around going short-term bonds, and that certainly served a lot of our clients very well.
I did, and again, that's just not because we have a crystal ball all the time with markets, but it's important that your wealth advisor and or the partner with whom you're working has an ear to the ground, is listening to what policymakers are saying. And they had been saying for quite some time that rates were going to be changing from the long-term zero interest rate policy that we'd been experiencing for a number of years. And sooner or later, that was brought to bear in the markets, and we were able to get ahead of that a little bit and insulate the portfolios of our clients.
Yeah. So in our second quarter commentary, we spoke about the rising correlation between stocks and bonds and the danger that can pose to investors. Can you speak to why this may be in danger and if past periods can offer any guidance for clients?
Sure. Well, first I'll speak to the normal correlation between stocks and bonds. And this goes a long way to defining portfolio theory that's characterized in investment strategies for the longer than my father, my grandfather, or my great-grandfather has been alive. The notion that stocks and bonds more often than not trade with negative correlation, meaning when stocks are up, bonds are down, and vice versa. This should make intuitive sense because stockholders and bondholders aren't always in alignment. Very frequently, they're not in alignment. And I'll give you an example. In a time of an expanding economy, lots of growth, and when money and credit is freely available, companies typically have an appetite to grow their business, grow their market share, make investments, doing things that don't necessarily mean that a bondholder who has lent to the same company is going to get their money back, depending on how their endeavors go. And the converse is also true. There are some periods when bonds and stocks can trade in sympathy, but it's typically a pretty short period of time around the inflection point of either policy on interest rates or the economic environment. What was seen for quite some time now, particularly coming out of the COVID lockdowns and the disruptions that were caused there, is that stocks and bonds are generally trading in the same direction. So stocks and bonds aren't performing their usual role of providing you countervailing impulses in your investment portfolio the way that they have in the past. We can talk a little bit about why that is, but typically that happens at a time when a market, more broadly speaking, across asset classes, is not necessarily functioning as smoothly as we'd like. Typically, it's a market where there are more investors involved than there are investment opportunities, and or the investment opportunities that abound are perfectly priced or close to perfectly priced. And in that environment, not just the correlation of the incumbent correlation that exists in markets might be problematic. It's also a sign that investors are probably all invested in the same strategies and in the same implements. And for that reason, it makes it trickier to create a portfolio that might mitigate your risk and optimize your return. And so it's something that we definitely keep an eye on. It's something that we've talked about internally. We continue to talk about internally, both on the daily or in our regular meetings with wealth advisors and also with the asset mix committee that exists here at TriDelta. And it's one of the things I keep on my dashboard to keep an eye that risk might be a little bit more elevated than the markets might be communicating.
Mm-hmm. And sticking with Q2, Canada got our long anticipated first cut to interest rates in June. The market began the year with some very optimistic views toward rate cuts, but of course that certainly hasn't materialized. I think more people would have anticipated greater volatility for stocks and bonds, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Do you have any comments as to why this may be?
I do, and to be fair, I think all market participants, ourselves, anyone you might see on business-related TV or markets-related TV, and policymakers themselves, are still sort of trying to read the tea leaves. We have to be mindful that all of the things that surrounded the pandemic and the shutdowns created a lot of upheaval both in the economy and in markets, a lot of dislocations, some of them positive, but for the most part, we're trying to figure out exactly the health of the various segments of the economy. And one of the things that people would have thought coming out of the pandemic was that a lot of the pent-up demand that the consumer has seen, a lot of the pent-up demand that the consumer had as not being able to normally interact with the choices in the consumption basket, how much travel they're going to participate in, how much clothing they had to buy, those sorts of things, we would have thought that the consumer would have exhausted itself at some point on its own and certainly would have been facing some headwinds in the face of higher debt servicing costs with rising interest rates. That hasn't really been the case. We've seen little pockets of the consumer flagging, both in Canada and in the U.S., and a little bit abroad as well. But I would say that the consumer has been remarkably resilient. And central bankers are, Bank of Canada bankers here, and the Federal Reserve bankers in the U.S. and other ones have noted this, the resilience, the ability of the consumer to continue to plow through and really buttress economic growth, such that it appears that the higher interest rates have not had the decelerating effects that one would have expected. And I think that goes a lot to say exactly how different our economy is than it was maybe before the pandemic and even before the long period of low interest rates. Beyond that, I think the reality is in the corporate sector, if you look at what's going on there, generally speaking, the corporate sector is in pretty good shape. They did a very good job of streamlining itself heading into the pandemic and then thereafter. We continue hearing earnings calls how companies will attempt to continue to grow income by increasing margins or maintaining margins or achieving productivity gains elsewhere. And companies have a lot of cash, and so they're not as negatively affected by the higher interest rate environment as one would have expected. So the transmission mechanism, as central bankers like to say, for higher interest rates into the economy to slow it and to take some of the heat out of inflation that we've been experiencing the last couple of years, isn't working the way it has in the past. And for that reason, We haven't had the long anticipated recession that one would have expected with the degree of interest rate hikes that we've had. And it continues to be a bit of a puzzle to be solved by central bankers and investors alike.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good response, and I have a few questions based off of that. My first one, just because of the order that you tackled that, you know, a lot of attention has been paid to the next 24 months as more and more people face mortgage renewals. How is the Canadian consumer doing, and is this an area of concern?
Well, first I'd say, just to follow on my prior comments, that the consumer has done a lot better mm-hmm. in Canada than one would have expected. We have seen pockets of weakness. The Canadian economy is a little bit more difficult to read than most because of its breadth and relatively small sample sizes of data. But, you know, in recent months, you know, the consumer is growing, still continuing to grow its consumption, depending on what metric you look at, between 1.5% and 2%, which is, you know, consistent with an economy that's operating at full capacity, and you wouldn't think that would be the case given what's gone on in interest rates. Mm-hmm. Looking ahead to mortgage renewals, we know that a significant proportion of the mortgage market is up for renewal over the next 18 to 24 months. A lot of those fixed mortgages are going to come with a fair amount of sticker shock. You know, you can see 2 to 3% jumps in your mortgage rates if we're going to see banks act consistently with what's gone on with policy rates more generally. It's enough of an issue that it's continually mentioned, both, you know, on Parliament Hill and with our regulators in and around Ottawa. OSFI, the Superintendent of Financial Institutions in Canada, is in frequent communication with the banks around getting ahead of this problem and guiding them to work with consumers and mortgagees to find a way to avert something more dastardly in the housing market. It's certainly going to be a challenge ahead, and it's sort of uncharted waters for any policymaker who's stationed in this market today and for investors today. We do anticipate further challenges for the Canadian consumer. We're, you know, relatively speaking, a little bearish on the Canadian economy for that reason. But we do think that tools exist to avert something more nasty ahead, provided that the regulators and the banks work closely together to navigate this period, but it's something about which we are keenly concerned and spend a lot of time monitoring on a daily basis on behalf of ourselves and for our clients.
Mm-hmm. And switching gears to the corporate side of things, we haven't seen too many issues with corporate credit so far this year. Do you think more companies will struggle perhaps towards the later half of the year or into 2025? Is there maybe a catalyst that you're watching for that could be, you know, a tipping point?
That's a very good question, and it's probably the thing I'm monitoring most closely on a daily basis. If you just looked at the pricing of credit in the market, there's nothing to indicate that there's material corporate stress, more broadly. Credit spreads are, you know, at their tightest, they're close to their tightest, credit spreads being the amount a company has to pay on top of government rates in order to borrow money. But I have seen in recent months and really recent weeks just pockets of what I would call sort of credit differentiation, you know, along the lines of what we spoke about earlier with respect to the correlation between stocks and bonds. The correlation between assets within sectors and within asset classes has been high as well, meaning, you know, it almost didn't matter for a while there which bond you bought, as long as it was triple B or single A or whatever flavor or credit quality you were looking for. Which is a sign of a market that's, you know, either overheated or is not doing a very good job of pricing risk, and we're starting to see some differentiation in recent weeks. So that's, I think, actually a good sign from myself, where I sit as an investor. I want to be paid for the risk that I'm taking, and I'm starting to see the likelihood that investors are going to be a little bit more discriminating moving forward. Whether or not that metastasizes into something more ominous is something that we're watching as well. I don't think, at this point in time, I don't see that as a probable outcome. But again, we're moving into a regime very unlike the one that we're exiting. So I'm watching credit spreads. I'm watching particularly the distressed credit. Everybody knows the story with respect to commercial real estate, some of the struggles there. But for the most part, I think we're just going to end up in an environment where we'll see more differences in the amount that companies have to pay to borrow. That will be more reflective of the credit qualities themselves, and that's something that's positive for all investors.
Yeah, it sounds like a good opportunity for an active manager as well.
Yeah, and that's when I think we're going to see differentiation between the quality of the performance of investment vehicles and advisors as well, and investment professionals as well.
Yeah. So one interesting area I've been following is around the likelihood of a recession. I know a lot of people have been inquiring about that as well. We know that many have softened their stance around a possible recession or a severity of one. Typically, recessions can be due to over-levered consumers and corporations, but today the most indebted area is actually in government. Does this change how you make decisions within your mandates? Should investors be concerned about this?
Well, I would say that indebtedness in general is the thing I spend most of my time on a daily basis. Obviously, as debt investors, we want people to be borrowing. We want them to be borrowing in a way that also will obviate we will get our money back and will be fairly compensated for the investments that we've made. The governments generally, governments globally, are as indebted as they've ever been. We shouldn't be surprised by this. They've been shouldering the load, sort of cleaning up the messes of, you know, the GFC in 2008, the PIGS crisis in Europe, and the COVID lockdown. Besides, governments never seem to shrink from an opportunity to borrow to smooth out the economic undulations that they may experience as a result of what's going on, sort of just in terms of organically in the economy. But the reality is the world was its position today. There are a great many more people who are seeking fixed income returns than there are investable fixed income opportunities. If we just think about the investment landscape, even from when I started in this business 25 years ago, we've had sort of the advent of the institutional investor, whether that be state-owned or a pension plan or some other endowment besides, who not only were heavy movers in markets sort of in the younger days of my career, but have since then moved on to take out whole businesses and privatize them so that they're no longer available. We've also seen a high degree of consolidation within publicly available issuers, just organically as we moved into more sort of an oligopolistic landscape. Not a lot of issuers, and those issuers that are out there, very high quality and best of brand and market leaders and everything else besides, but typically they don't really need your money. So the reality is governments are very well aware of this dynamic and have used the opportunity to borrow and spend rather than maybe make some tougher decisions. Certainly, we have lots of situations in which government debt has caused larger problems, and it's something about which we think about daily here at Tri-Delta. I don't see a problem more imminently, but again, I think as we move into this era of more discriminating tastes in debt markets, I think governments are probably increasingly going to be brought to heel on what they're doing fiscally, and that'll manifest its way through the yield curve, which again, I think, provided it doesn't turn into something more ominous, will be an opportunity for investors to be more fairly compensated than they are today.
So as we get closer to the end here, I wanted to ask if you have any favorite names in your strategies.
I guess I should put forward a couple of names that dovetail with what we've been talking about here today. The environment as I've characterized it is one in which money is going to be a little less available, credit's going to be a little less available than it has in the past, and so it does behoove us to partner with some companies who we think are very well operated and are going to be around for a while and be mindful of what they're doing with our money. And again, we do want to still be reasonably compensated for partnering with them. So I'm going to talk about the names themselves rather than particular bonds, because the bonds we select depends on what we think about yield curve or credit spread in that part of the sector. But the names are consistent themes, and Kyle, you know you've seen these names before. The first one I'm going to talk about, I think, is Terranet. Terranet Inc. or Terranet Holdings Limited Partnership. It's a wholly owned operating company of OMERS, or the pension plan that handles retirements for municipal employees here in Ontario. It is basically the monopoly land registry system operator here in Ontario and in Manitoba. They offer those services to governments, real estate companies, surveyors, anybody who'd be interested in them, rather. And they also are seeking to provide probably something that's very harmonious with the current AI fervor, provide entirely integrated solutions to any of those customer bases for everything from property lines to ESG mandates, environmental surveys, and the like. As I say, it's a wholly owned company of OMERS. And OMERS is itself a double A issuer. But the sub that issues the bonds is triple B, so it's a little bit lower down the quality curve. But again, being a wholly owned sub, you would expect it has the support of the sponsor. They had been a lower rated company, and interest rates, or rather yields that you would expect on those bonds would have been a lot higher. But over time, the investment market has gotten used to seeing OMERS manage the business prudently. But you still get a yield pickup over OMERS or any other government bond. We've owned it in a variety of stripes in the models over time. It's a company that we like. They're very mindful of how they use capital, growing, but I guess as an equity investor, we might say grow at a reasonable price, and we've partnered with them for some time and see some room for improvement as it gets upgraded by credit rating agencies, rather, and more scope for spreads to tighten over time. A second name that we all know is Dollarama, and that's a name that we've owned pretty consistently here at Tri-Delta since I've been here, and I've been investment in them years before as well. Those prior years, they were really hallmarked by aggressive growth, both organic and through acquisitions. They borrowed a lot, spent a lot to grow their footprint to where they are today. It's a $6 billion annual revenue company. They've got close to 1,600 stores here in Canada, and through investment partnerships abroad, they've got an investment in Dollar City, which is another dollar store that is more Latin American based. They sort of have a free option there. But in recent years, they've done a much better job of bringing their balance sheet back to something that's more palatable for bond investors. They've gotten sort of by many debt metrics, one of them which we look at is sort of like net debt to what they're earning. It's moving its way towards 2x. Triple B rated company. We like it a lot. And we think also because they're making a pretty concerted push into ESG compliance, it's a name that's going to be increasingly adopted by those investors who have those mandates, and I think there's scope for those yields to come down as well, which would be cap appreciation for us who own it.
That's great. That's some really good information. Thanks again for joining me, Paul. For any listeners who have not already read our Q2 2024 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit our insights page on the website. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series.